Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in National Security. I'm Paul, the host of the channel. Today, we're going to be discussing Fountainhead of Jihad, The Haqqani Nexus, 1973-2012, jointly authored by Don Rassler and Vahid Brown, and published by Oxford University Press. Fountainhead of Jihad is a meticulously researched and remarkably detailed exposition of the Haqqani Network's growth and ongoing importance among Pakistani militant organizations. Beginning with an expansive history of the Haqqani family's background and subsequent emergence as a critical linchpin in the Pakistani, and by extension U.S., anti-Soviet efforts in Afghanistan, the book goes on to cover the Haqqani's present operations, including its involvement in attacks on NATO, Indian, and government forces in Afghanistan. By shedding light on a group that, while sometimes mentioned in news media, is largely unknown to non-specialists, Fountain of Jihad is a majorly scholarly contribution to the subject of South Asian extremism. The book is in large part based on fascinating primary source material, much of it gleaned from seized documents contained in the U.S. military's Harmony database, and media produced by the Haqqanis and other militant actors. Those interested in Pakistani intelligence's relationship to extremism, the past and future of militancy in South Asia, and terrorist modus operandi more generally will all benefit from a close reading of Fountainhead of Jihad. After reading the book, I also believe that some familiarity with the Haqqani network is a prerequisite to understand the emergence and continued existence of Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. While insurgency rages on in Syria and Iraq, and attention on South Asian terrorism has waned somewhat, I have little doubt that the Haqqanis will continue to be a key actor in the great game between Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, long after the demise of ISIL, Jabhat al-Nusra, and other more recent additions to the Sunni militant scene. Among both scholars and practitioners, the counterterrorism community would be well advised to have a thorough understanding of the Haqqanis, and I suspect there is no better source to acquire this understanding from than Fountainhead of Jihad. Hi, Don, and welcome to New Books in National Security. It's great to have you here to talk about your book.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for the opportunity. Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. So I was thinking perhaps you could start us off with a little bit about yourself and how you came to study this particular field.
Sure. So I work at the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point and in the Social Sciences Department there. I've been there since 2008. And while at the CTC, most of my research has been focused on South and Central Asia, looking at groups like the Haqqanis. I also work a lot with U.S. Special Operations Command and manage a program that works to get information declassified and put out to the public to help us understand different organizations like the Haqqanis or Al-Qaeda. Prior to coming to the CTC, I worked in defense consulting as well as on the Capitol Hill down in D.C. for a little while. I also have a background working and living in India for a human rights organization, so sort of an eclectic background. Master's in international affairs with a focus on security policy. How I got into the terrorism studies field is it was a topic that I had a long interest in, and the opportunity to apply and eventually work at the CTC arose. And it's this entrepreneurial place. And so for a younger person like myself, it was a great opportunity to create and do interesting things. And that's a little bit about how I got to what I'm doing, as well as the book.
So how did you come to begin work with Vahid Brown on Fountainhead of Jihad?
Yeah, so when I started at the CTC, Vahid, you know, the center's a small place. And Vahid, the center was founded in 2003. And Vahid, in about 2005, started to work with the CTC on a bunch of different projects. Vahid has a unique skill set. He's an Arabist, so he has Arabic language skills as well as Farsi. And so, you know, Vahid was working on different projects. And when I came to the CTC, I was asked to set up a South Asia research portfolio. Vahid had done a lot of work in that area. He'd also looked extensively at the history of Al-Qaeda. And so, you know, in beginning to set up that program, I reached out to Vahid. We had a variety of different conversations about potential topics that we could pursue as a center, as well as collaboratively, that we thought would, you know, inform key debates and also, you know, trying to identify what the strategic gaps were in the literature. One of the main first projects that we actually worked on was in 2007 or in 2008, looking at the early evolution of the Tariqi Taliban Pakistan and the role of Baitullah Masood. And then after that, Vahid and I began to understand that, you know, through that work, really the importance of the Haqqanis, and that there was a huge opportunity to provide value and, you know, contribute to that problem set. And so Vahid and I just embarked on a multi-year journey to do that, which was exciting and involved, at least for myself, travel to Afghanistan and seeking out, identifying different primary sources and just trying to push that conversation forward as much as we could. And Vahid and I still try and work on different projects together, or at least talk about them. And it's been a pleasure to work with him.
That's great. So the introduction sort of spells out the meaning behind the title and the subtitle of the book really nicely. I understand that Fountainhead of Jihad is the English translation of Manbal Jihad, which is the name of the Haqqani Network's media studios, but there's a lot of other things going on in that title. So I was hoping you could unpack for us the various meanings of those key words in the title, Fountainhead, Jihad, Nexus, and so forth.
Sure. So when we were thinking about the title for the book, the name Fountainhead of Jihad just jumped out to us because, you know, Fountainhead, Manbal Jihad or Fountainhead of Jihad in English, came from, it's not just their media, the name of their media studio through which they released digital products since about 2004 onwards and to this day. But during the anti-Soviet jihad, there were a lot of the, you know, Afghan and Arabic organizations that were active, you know, in that conflict began to release a variety of different print media products. And so there was this whole community of publishing houses. And the Haqqani Network from 1989 to 1993 actually ended up releasing three different magazines, monthly magazines, different versions in Arabic, Urdu, and Pashto. And so there's thousands of pages of primary source material. And the name that the Haqqani Network decided that, you know, how they decided to brand their organization in this, at least the magazine, in Arabic and in Pashto was Manbal Jihad. And so Fountainhead, you know, and the title comes from the name of the actual magazines that the Haqqanis produced themselves during this period. And the title that they selected, I think, says a lot about the role that they viewed their organization playing in the region, not only at that period, but also potentially into the future, which is something we try to unpack in the book. In terms of jihad, you know, there are many different interpretations of the term jihad, you know, as we explain, in terms of, you know, on one level, it could mean strife or internal struggle, sort of on a personal level. Jihad can also mean violent, sort of militant action. And the Haqqani Network, at least in terms of how they characterized jihad in their magazines, was, you know, about combat and violent action. And the different institutions that they set up were geared to educate people and prepare people to think about why, you know, this type of activity was needed. In terms of Nexus, so the Fountainhead of Jihad, Haqqani Nexus, we thought long and hard about the Haqqani. You know, typically people describe the Haqqanis as the Haqqani Network. And we believe that given the organization's unique role and the role that the group has played over multiple decades, acting as a strategic enabler or a connector between different organizations, that we thought it was important to highlight and sort of shift the debate a little bit and to highlight this nexus role that the organization played and continues to play across different communities. 1973 to 2013, we selected that date range because most of the analyses of the Haqqani Network prior to, with few exceptions, prior to the work that me and Vahid did, really focused on the starting point of analysis was the anti-Soviet jihad from 1979 to 1989. And most sort of narratives pick up sort of in the mid-1980s, particularly when Jalal and Haqqani really had a relationship with the United States. That's useful as a starting point, but we believe through the primary sources that we looked at that that sort of masks and, you know, if you start there, did not provide you with an as complete of an understanding of really the early role that the Haqqanis played in Afghanistan and beyond from 1973 onwards. And so even before the Soviets got there, they had established a people like Jalal and Haqqani were quite active. So that's the reason for the title of the book.
Thanks, Don. So I also really appreciated your extensive citations and your reliance on so many primary sources. You had a lot of citations from seized documents that are contained in the U.S. military's Harmony database, as well as media produced by the Haqqanis themselves and other militant actors. Can you tell us a little bit about your methodological approach to the project, and what was the experience of working with these sort of very unique sources?
Sure. So when we began the project, one of the things that, you know, Vahid and my goal was to cast a net as wide as we could to try and seek out literally everything that we could get our hands on in terms of like the discovery phase of the project for the the Haqqanis are produced by the Haqqanis or groups and organizations that might have something interesting to say about the organization. And so in that process, we, you know, given some of the work that we do, we do and have done at CTC, we look at capture battlefield documents, material recovered in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and working with different partners within the Department of Defense. We have some of that material declassified and pushed out for release. And so that was an initial place that we went to try and look for information about the Haqqanis. And within the primary database that this information's stored in, which is called the Harmony database, what we found was that there was a lot of information about the Haqqanis. This information was captured at safe houses associated with people like Jalal and Haqqani and his key lieutenants during the early days of the U.S. invasion in October and November of 2001. And what was interesting about this information was that it was primarily in Pashto and Dari. And so, you know, in the early days of the invasion, U.S. focus is on al-Qaeda and Arabic language material. And so, you know, less attention and priority was given to studying or looking at the Pashto and Dari material, even though it was associated with people like, you know, Jalal and Haqqani, even letters penned by him and signed by him and his commanders. You know, so there was a less emphasis given to that material. So what we did was went and studied that material and tried to pull out as much material as we could. So that was one source of information in terms of primary sources. The other main source was the magazines that I mentioned that were produced by the Haqqani Network from 1989 to 1993. And what was interesting about that information, that batch of documents, is that this material was, you know, the Haqqanis play such an important role in Afghanistan, you know, over multiple decades and, you know, particularly after 2001 and as a, you know, formidable foe for the United States and coalition partners. Yet this material was publicly available at a library in Kabul. And actually through a twist of irony is that the material was being digitized by an endowment paid for through the National Endowment for Humanities. So a U.S. entity, you know, one part of the government paying to digitize this, you know, the library of the collection of this library in Kabul. And yet nobody was really studying this material, given, you know, which is unfortunate because, you know, the strategic role that the organization was playing. We also looked at a variety of different memoirs that were produced by Al-Qaeda-linked fighters, foreign fighters, as well as some local fighters who were active in Afghanistan and Pakistan during the 1980s and 1990s and the present day. So using some of those primary sources, we tried to triangulate different perspectives. We also found some memoirs of, you know, foreign fighters who had embedded with the Haqqanis, somebody like Abu Walid al-Masri, whose real name is Mustafa Hamid. His lengthy autobiographical, you know, notes about his direct experiences fighting with the Haqqanis in the 1980s and 90s. We also looked at secondary source material, and so everything that we could find in English, other European languages, because there's been some interesting court cases of foreign fighters who had operated with Al-Qaeda figures who had Haqqani connections. We also conducted interviews with as many people as we could, specialists who had, you know, with a lot of field work in the region, other academic specialists, people who work for the government, different military communities who have experience combating operating in Haqqani areas. So that's sort of the material that we were able to look at. In terms of methodological challenges, I would be remiss if I did not mention that, while we tried to push the ball forward in terms of making the Haqqanis the focus of study and enhancing, you know, the collective understanding about this group, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. And what other information that would have been nice to have, which would enhance further follow-on studies of the Haqqanis, would be field research. As you can imagine, field research for people like Vahid and myself in Afghanistan or the tribal areas of Pakistan is a bit challenging. And it would be useful to hear sort of more current perspectives from Haqqani leaders or Haqqani commanders in their own words. I think that would be valuable. So that's one area that deserves additional focus. We've also heard rumor that Jalaluddin Haqqani has a diary, and I think it would be valuable, you know, if that's true, and if that diary is eventually released, sort of his autobiographical text, I think that would be tremendously informative as well.
So I found that cultural and physical geography came up quite a bit early in the book, and it seems to have played a very important role in the emergence of the Haqqani network and then its continued preeminence in the area. And you describe the world into which Jalaluddin Haqqani was born as a maelstrom of borderland violence, an area rife with armed defense of Pashtun independence, violent resistance to state meddling with tribal and Islamic customs, and large-scale mobilizations against foreign invasions, in the words of the book. How did this highland Pashtun region, its culture and its history, give rise to the Haqqanis?
Well, just as you stated, there's a tradition that in that particular region of Afghanistan and in Afghanistan more broadly, of resistance to foreign invasion, foreign occupation, foreign influence. Notable examples stand out. Obviously, the British campaigns in Afghanistan. You also have the classic case of the Fakir of Ipi, who is someone who was from the Waziristan region, and when the Brits were still in British India, that when they tried to gain more influence and exert more control in the Waziristan area, there was an indigenous movement that was set up to rebel against that influence. And so while nowadays different actors like the Haqqani Network, who reside in a place like Waziristan, focus most of their attention westward to, you know, U.S. forces, Afghan government, maybe Indian influence in Afghanistan. So focusing west during the, prior days, Fakir of Ipi looked eastward to actually fight the British and their proxies, and would sort of mobilize different communities from places like Afghanistan, southeastern Afghanistan specifically, towards their cause. And so there's, for these types of issues, tribal solidarity plays an important role in resisting this type of influence. And so there's a long-standing legacy of, you know, people like Jalaluddin Haqqani actually sort of stepping into, you know, a certain lineage, if you will, of individuals, you know, and also just an ethos that permeates the region that they're a part of.
It seems like geography really plays a central role in terms of the Haqqani's strategic location vis-a-vis some key routes into Afghanistan. Is that the case?
It absolutely is. And so, you know, one of the, you know, when we thought about the Haqqanis and tried to step back from what we were learning about the group, we tried to sort of, one of the things that we were frustrated with in terms of analysis of the organization was that, you know, beyond there being actually very little work, developed work that had been done on the Haqqani Network's history, reaching back multiple decades, was that when you ask people about, you know, why are the Haqqanis so influential? Why are they so resilient? You know, why are they the most lethal, you know, described as the most lethal actor in Afghanistan, the most sort of strategic actor, you know, described by some people, because of some of the attacks they do in Kabul and whatnot. We were just really unsatisfied with the response, because the response we would normally get would be, oh, it's because the Haqqani Network has areas of safe haven across the border. Okay, well, that's obviously important to have safe haven and, you know, access, easy access maybe to a place like Kabul. So what we tried to do is to think about it a bit more analytically and try to sort of see maybe potentially other reasons why the organization was so effective, not just in terms of the current campaign since 2001, but in prior conflicts as well. And there's a variety of different reasons that we came up with. One of them is one that you're pointing to, which is something that we characterize as geographic centrality. And so the Haqqanis, they have historically described themselves as primarily an Afghan organization or Afghan group. And they are, you know, their identity, you know, Jalaluddin Haqqani, his sons, they are Afghan. But it sort of glosses over this point of, well, yes, they're Afghan, but the organization has made a dedicated effort since the mid-1970s to actually set up infrastructure across the border in Pakistan, in Mir Ali, in Mirim Shah, in the Waziristan region, to sort of set up as a home base, a logistics home base. So there's that safe haven piece. But what was interesting about it is that we looked at some of the transfer of material during the anti-Soviet jihad and sort of where hardware was going through. And there's an interesting account provided by a former director of Pakistan's Inner Services Intelligence Directorate, which he discusses at length in a book that he produced, where he talks about how I think it was up to a third of the material that was being funneled into Afghanistan to support the Mujahideen against the Soviets during that time was going through a key location, you know, that was controlled by Jalaluddin Haqqani, and specifically a base called Zawara, which is in southeastern Afghanistan. And at this base, you know, so you have all this material funneling through. It's also an important location that the Pakistanis actually decided to reinforce when it was attacked by the Soviets, and to reportedly they also sent personnel there, which would, you know, was also a first for them to do. So there's that issue. That's the historic component. You also see it's not really being an accident that when people think about, all right, well, what led sort of the conditions that led to the fall of the Afghan government to the Mujahideen in the early 1990s? One of the catalysts for and major events that sort of preceded it was the fall of Host Garrison in the province of Host in Afghanistan. and Jalal, that's territory controlled by the Haqqanis. And so there's this rich history of sort of resistance, but also a lot of materiel, and also this interesting place where you have this collection of geographic centrality in terms of, you know, a lot of this is also involved with Jalaluddin Haqqani's views on his open-mindedness to allow different types of fighters to embed with his organization and his network, and doing so early on, which made them also more effective. Fast forward to the current day, you know, you have the Haqqani sort of, you know, when there are strategic attacks conducted in Kabul, the Haqqanis are typically, you know, either described as or actually the agents who are conducting those attacks. And there's geographic reasons for that. They have networks, you know, from Waziristan and those areas of safe haven. It's actually the quickest way to get to Kabul is to go directly through the territory of southeastern Afghanistan that the Haqqanis have historically had the most, you know, ownership of in terms of militancy. You know, some of the other reasons leading their effectiveness are things like organizational centrality, which we can talk about, as well as the Haqqani's just willingness to work with a lot of different actors and their ability to manage different relationships. But organization, you know, the geographic area that this group is located in and their ability to, you know, exploit that to their benefit, their survival, and, you know, not only play across the border to enhance their campaigns, but also figuring out ways that will allow them to consistently be strategic, whether that's through the fall of Khost Garrison in the early 1990s or strategic attacks in Kabul today, is something that the Haqqanis, you know, are good at. And so they are, you know, have definitely illustrated a capability to, you know, an awareness of maximizing their geographic space to their own benefit.
Talking about relationships with different actors, what was the context of Pakistan's initial involvement with the Haqqani network, and just how closely did Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI, work alongside the Haqqanis during that initial anti-Soviet jihad?
So the Haqqani's connection to the Pakistan security establishment, and particularly its military, its Pakistan's army, and even more specifically, Pakistan's Inter Services Intelligence Directorate, reaches back quite far, actually. You know, one of the areas that would be useful to know for there to be additional sort of primary sources or evidence is the period of the late 1970s. You know, there are some indications that Jalal and Haqqani's relationship to that establishment reaches back to that time period. During the, you know, anti-Soviet jihad and that conflict, the ties were actually quite rich. And I'll give you some examples. So, you know, there's primary source documentation, actual letters that were addressed to the Jalal and Haqqani, as well as his group in general, that talk about, you know, there's, you know, one example is there was a request that was sent saying, you know, these following, you know, three Punjabi, Pakistani military officers, you know, would like to embed with you and fight with you in Afghanistan as part of the Mujahideen, please allow them to do so. So this is a letter that's sort of coming, you know, directly from Pakistan's military, just notifying or sort of requesting Haqqani to support this. Again, it's a different time and place, you know. During the 1980s, you also have late 1980s, the United States actually supporting Jalaluddin Haqqani, as he was one of the individuals that the U.S. sought out to partner with, and actually he was one of the first people that was entrusted with Stinger missiles, so the game-changing technology that helped to bring down Russian helicopters and change the entire dynamic of the war. So, you know, another example would be in terms of the ties between Pakistan security establishment and Jalal and Haqqani, you know, there's a series of fascinating telex communications that were recovered in Afghanistan that go from the late 1980s up to the early 1990s so even after the Soviets were gone, that is a, you know, in these communications, you have, there's basically field-based communications between different outstations in Afghanistan, so different sort of Mujahideen control points, one of them being Zawara, and so that one was sort of staffed by the Haqqanis. But then you have dialogue and communication directly with Pakistan's security establishment, where you see things, you know, where the Pakistanis will talk, you know, mention, oh, well, congratulations on capturing Khost Garrison. Congratulations on the fall, you know, on the fall of Gardez, to the extent of even sort of trying to, after these campaigns, pushing, providing strategic direction, trying to push the Haqqanis or encourage them and the Mujahideen in general to go to other areas. So that's one element. You also have indications of funding being paid at that time. And that's documented in those communications. You also have, you know, support would range to even trivial things like we need more sandals and fuel, you know, for our generator. So a lot of what the Haqqanis needed appears to have been supplied by Pakistan and its different partners at the time, potentially the United States, you know, and other states. So that's the historical component. And then when you sort of enter into the 1990s, you have people like Hamid Ghul, who is another director of Pakistan's Inter-Service Intelligence Directorate, you know, being on record stating that when he wanted his, you know, when his son went to go fight in Afghanistan, he made sure that his son went to fight with Jalaluddin Haqqani. Now, you know, it's you could imagine that, at least in theory, the director of, you know, this important institution in Pakistan would, you know, not let his son just go fight with, average Joe. It clearly illustrates that Jalaluddin Haqqani was somebody that was trusted, was sort of in the inner circle, at least within, for somebody like Hamid Ghul, and that he believed that maybe that was the best person that his son should go fight with. In terms of current day and the relationship between, or at least the relationship between the Pakistani security establishment and the Haqqanis since 2001. This has been a bit of a, you know, looking into this issue is a bit like looking into a black box. You know, both organizations are covert organizations. And so it's hard to establish with great fidelity what exactly that relationship looks like. However, there are various, you know, pieces of information that elucidate the contours of that relationship, or at least what we think the contours of that relationship are. For example, you know, there are, and this is, you know, in newspaper articles like the New York Times, about, you know, after the Indian embassy was attacked with a suicide car bomb in 2009, in which the Indian's defense attaché was killed, which was a strategic attack, sort of a signaling attack, you know, it's basically, you know, warning the Indians to sort of limit their influence, stay out of Afghanistan. You know, according to these open source reports, you know, which are based upon, I think, cell phone intercepts, the Haqqani commanders were talking with, in communication with ISI agents in the paper, seemed to suggest that they were receiving direction from Pakistan's intelligence service to conduct this type of attack.
It seems that this was the period that the Haqqani network's relationship with the forerunners of the individuals who would eventually become al-Qaeda began to emerge. What was this initial relationship between the Haqqanis and these individuals like, and how has the Haqqani network's relationship with al-Qaeda persisted to this day?
So that's actually one of the interesting things about the Haqqani network, is that when we started to look back into their history, one of the things that we found tremendously interesting was that there was this narrative that existed about al-Qaeda and its early history and the history of sort of the Arab foreign fighters in Afghanistan, you know, active during the anti-Soviet jihad. The predominant narrative was that, you know, these fighters and, you know, al-Qaeda specifically, after being founded in 1988, sort of were primarily partnered with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Abdul Rasul Saif. So sort of two other Afghan Islamists, leaders, Mujahideen party leaders, and you know the foreign fighters, as well as Al Qaeda after it was formed, certainly had relationships with these two individuals. But what was interesting was that the Haqqanis actually played a, we argue in the book, a more important role in terms of the early development of Al-Qaeda than those two individuals. And we argue that that's the case because when you actually look at the early operational development of sort of the proto-Al-Qaeda, so groups like the Maktab al-Kidamat, the Afghan Services Bureau, as well as just the specific, you know, activity of key personalities. For example, you know, I mentioned Abu Walid al-Masri. You know, he's, you know, has extensively documented through his own records of sort of the evolution of Arab fighting units, you know, alongside Jalaluddin Haqqani, and that something that was different about Jalaluddin Haqqani vice other leaders was vice other Afghan Mujahideen leaders was that he seemed to be a bit more inclusive and open-minded about allowing these different Arab foreign fighters to operate, you know, in his battle space and with his units. You know, because there was this view that by some of the other Afghan Mujahideen leaders that, oh, the Arab fighters, they're crazy. They just want to die. They don't really have good battlefield experience. So, you know, we're going to take their money, but we're not really interested in, you know, allowing them to fight. And Jalaluddin Haqqani is on record as early as 1981 in a speech that he made in the UAE, where he talks about, encouraging young Muslim youth from that part of the world to come to Afghanistan and to come to fight with him. That wasn't a message that at that time that, at least as we understand it, that other Afghan Mujahideen leaders were making. So he distinguished himself in that regard in terms of allowing some of these individuals to fight. And so there's the element of, providing that opportunity, which is something that has continued, throughout the decades. And there's multiple examples of that. But there's also the issue of who actually, so there's a qualitative dimension to this, in terms of who actually went and embedded with Jalaluddin Haqqani during those early days. So you have people like Abu Walid al-Masri, who was never really formally a member of Al-Qaeda, but did play a role in terms of helping to shape the development of the group. But you also have Al-Qaeda's, you know, first and second, you know, military commanders, or the leaders of Al-Qaeda's military section, you know, when they were fighting in the early days in Afghanistan, they were also fighting alongside Jalaluddin Haqqani. Key battles that some of the other Arab fighters that were involved in occurred in southeastern Afghanistan. Part of the reason why the community of terrorism scholars and academics have sort of missed this is they have sort of emphasized Arabic language material about Al-Qaeda, which is obviously is important, but you also need to look at, you know, I think where we provide value with, in terms of understanding that relationship is also through Urdu and Pashto language material, primary source. So there's that issue. And also sort of switching the lens of analysis to, you know, from Peshawar, which was the main logistic hub for all the different groups, to also look at others, you know, what could be characterized as sort of other centers of gravity for the development, not just of the Mujahideen, but also for Al-Qaeda, particularly operational areas like Loya Paktia, what is today Paktika and Host, because that area is really where we saw the Arab fighters who would go on to lead Al-Qaeda in its formative years really cut their teeth. So that's sort of on the operational side. In the 1990s, you also have, you know, we would argue that it's really not an accident that when you look at the development of and the location of Al-Qaeda's training camp infrastructure in Afghanistan, and there were, you know, a variety of camps in different places, some of the most important camps were in southeastern Afghanistan, in areas that, you know, where Jalaluddin Haqqani either he controlled, you know, the broader area around those camps, or he had sort of the most chutzpah or sway in those areas. You know, we would argue, based upon the evidence that we've seen, that that's not really an accident. You also see things like Jalal and Haqqani, well, in the Haqqani magazines, certain articles that talk about, you know, in the early 1990s, you know, the need to expand jihad to other parts of the globe. And you actually see Jalal and Haqqani being on record talking about the need to sort of take the jihad to Sudan, to Bangladesh, to other places, which is not something that many other Afghan Mujahideen leaders were as engaged in. So there's that's sort of some of the historical context. You know, you also have an important event in 1998 when Al-Qaeda's second fatwa against the United States, where Al-Qaeda formally and broadly declared war on the U.S., was not done in southern Afghanistan, in a place like Kandahar. It was done at a camp controlled by Jalal and Haqqani. You know, it's likely that this didn't happen by accident. You know, that, and it, you know, this is a strategic location. And so when you see, you know, post 2001, the conflict in Afghanistan sort of ramping up, you know, the area where we saw the highest levels of foreign fighter integration from the 2004 to at least 2009 time period was in southeastern Afghanistan. And so, you know, again, we get back to this geographic centrality issue where Haqqani's base in Waziristan, it's not just the Haqqanis that are based there in places like Miram Shah, but it was also, you know, remnants of Al-Qaeda, other foreign fighting units that were based there, as well as in other nearby areas. And when they wanted to fight, because of some of the historical experience, you know, the Haqqanis had always seemed willing to allow these individuals to embed with them. There are multiple cases of this in terms of actual individuals that we can tie to some of this activity. A good case is a guy named Abu Nasir al-Qahtani, who was an Al-Qaeda, Saudi Al-Qaeda member, who was actually arrested in 2005, you know, was held by U.S. forces, escaped from custody, went back to Waziristan, continued with his fight, recruiting people, training people to include foreign fighters who wanted to conduct attacks against European countries, and then going, you know, was eventually arrested again, conducting video surveillance of a forward operating base called FOB Salerno in hosts in southeastern Afghanistan. So we see there being operational ties, and some people, you know, the debate really is, you know, so there's clear tactical and operational collaboration, and really where there's a disagreement in the sort of analytical community is about to what extent the Haqqanis have had a strategic relationship with Al-Qaeda. The case that we make in the book is that by, you know, some of the ideas that were articulated, you know, by Jalal and Haqqani and others, not only does there appear to be some sort of synergy in that space, but that there was, you know, that some of those words were also being backed up by deeds and actions and shared resources. You know, a good example would be after the 1998 Al-Qaeda's attacks against the East African, the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The U.S. in retaliation conducted a cruise missile strike, and they targeted Al-Qaeda's training bases, and the Haqqanis are on record talking about that some of their fighters actually died in those cruise missile strikes. So you sort of see that collaboration even during that period.
You describe the Haqqanis as having enormous value and importance to the Pakistani state. in terms of their ability to kinetically strike Pakistan's opponents, like you mentioned, the attack on the Indian embassy, and to broker cooperation among the various militant organizations in northwest Pakistan. But this arrangement seems to come with some very serious risks for Pakistan, which is waging its own war on Al-Qaeda and the TTP, and has to at the same time manage its alliance with the United States. Can you tell us a little bit more about this balancing act that Pakistan has to perform in its relations with the Haqqanis?
Sure. It is a challenging balancing act for Pakistan. When we typically think about Pakistan's relationship with the Haqqani, we typically think about it with respect to Afghanistan and sort of the Haqqanis being a historical and current tool for, Pakistan and security agencies to project influence, power in Afghanistan and to signal to various actors like the Indians about their activity. That's important. But another dimension to this, which sort of is usually treated in less detail, is the sort of relationship between the Haqqanis and Pakistan with respect to Pakistan, and particularly with respect to the tribal areas. And so the Pakistani security establishment lacks influence in a place like Waziristan, and in order to mediate with different entities to try and manage militant activity, and particularly anti-state activity, so conducted by entities like the Tehrik-i Taliban Pakistan, the TTP, waging a jihad, a war against the state of Pakistan because of, the perception of Pakistan's security relationship with the United States, as well as Pakistan's meddling in the Waziristan region and actual conflict that it's conducted against these different organizations, to sort of help broker and, for the state to manage some of that activity, you see, and there's numerous documented examples of Pakistan actually working sort of in a, by, with, and through the Haqqanis, with key Haqqani figures sort of serving as mediators to mediate disputes, to try and get hostages released. You have this dynamic where Pakistan's in a difficult place because it has, this historical relationship with Jalal and Haqqani, with the Haqqani network. The Haqqani network has proven itself to be at least at the surface level, a reliable and sort of trusted partner because of its ability to conduct strategic attacks like the Indian Embassy attack or other sort of engagements. So it's useful in that regard, also useful, on the Pakistan side of the border, as I mentioned. Pakistan faces a significant militancy problem in terms of its anti-state actors. Why this is difficult for Pakistan is because groups like the TTP or elements of the TTP, which is basically an alliance of different sub-tribally organized units, which are usually geographically organized as well. Elements of the TTP will plug in and fight, gain combat experience in Afghanistan, working with the Haqqanis. And so the Haqqanis are also at an awkward spot where they're sort of live in the same area as the TTP and need to sort of be on good grounds with some of the TTP actors and the state of play in that region and form alliances to do that. Yet for Pakistan to exert influence, in Afghanistan, in the Waziristan region, it also needs to rely on the Haqqanis. And the unfortunate thing, what makes this even more challenging for Pakistan is that it appears as though Pakistan does not have many other good options to play the type of role that the Haqqanis play in Afghanistan or in Pakistan. And so what Pakistan has been trying to do is to walk this fine line between, pursuing a security policy that sort of differentiates, or at least historically tries to differentiate between good and bad sort of Taliban or good and bad jihadi. But the challenging part of that is that these organizations, they collaborate on one side of the border, yet, in theory, they don't collaborate on the other side of the border. But that's not entirely the case. So how do you manage the spillover? You know, and Pakistan does not, despite some of the things that it says, it doesn't want to go in and, you know, fully take, go after the Haqqanis, because I think there's a recognition from their side that doing so would stir up an even bigger hornet's nest, an even bigger problem than they can handle. So what they've been trying to do is to chip away at their sort of anti-state militancy problem by breaking groups apart and using the Haqqanis as a method or, in some cases, tool to do that, or at least to communicate with other actors in that region. You know, things that complicate this complicate the relationship are events like the assassination of Nasiruddin Haqqani, so one of Jalaluddin Haqqani's sons, outside of Islamabad, in broad daylight. You know, still not really known who conducted that attack. You know, people make the case that the relationship between Pakistan and the Haqqanis is changing. That might be the case, although it seems as though, I guess what I would argue is that there's not enough sort of definitive evidence to actually indicate that that's actually what's going on.
Now, much like other major jihadist organizations, the Hezbollahs and Hamases of the world, Haqqanis maintain an extensive network of infrastructure. They have religious institutions, they run military camps, propaganda outlets. How have these institutions benefited the Haqqanis and influenced their relationship with more global actors such as Al-Qaeda?
The Haqqanis, given that they have been quite active in the region for a long period of time, as you said, have well-developed infrastructure, and you know that includes centers for learning, madrasas, religious institutions, so different schools that the organization has set up, to include their seminal institution that they used to run called Mamba Alum in North Waziristan. And so the benefit of these different institutions is that, by providing an outlet for education for local youth, and typically education that is, providing sort of room and board and food, as well as education, provides an opportunity for youth to, for the Haqqanis to educate people into their particular worldview and their own interpretation of Islam and how they believe should view current events as well as how to respond to those events. And so I think that that's one benefit. You also have other benefits too in terms of this infrastructure where the Haqqanis have given, linkages to places like Dar al-Ulum Haqqaniyah, which is a key seminal madrasa in northwest Pakistan, out close to Peshawar, where Jalaluddin Haqqani actually studied and taught for a period. So linkages with different religious parties in the country. And sometimes the magazines talked about some of these relationships and how sort of speculated how that they could be financial relationships as well. And so you also have, through this network, when people talk about Haqqani network financing, they typically talk about things like Gulf donors and things like that. And I can talk about that in a second. But there's also this local network through which they can raise funds to sort of to contribute to the fight, to contribute to the jihad. And so that, at least as we understand it, is a well-established network. You also have, in places like the Gulf, the Haqqanis having relationships with what appear to be, at least historical relationships with some powerful people. Again, different time, different conflict. But it's unclear to what extent some of those relationships might have carried over and continued. And it also appears, and it's hard to sort of pin these things down with, precise information. But it appears that the Haqqanis, people, talk about the Haqqanis being involved in certain industries, whether that's things like real estate, in other parts of the globe, or through transport in Pakistan, or maybe even internationally, as well as, you know, connections with maybe some transport things across the border in Afghanistan. You know, and so it's I think that the important takeaway with this is that the Haqqanis have been in business for a long time. You know, one of the main ways that Jalaluddin Haqqani, just to sort of illustrate his entrepreneurialism, is that after the, you know, anti-Soviet jihad, when the Russians left, there were was a lot of, in a place like Host at the airstrip in Host, there's a lot of sort of downed planes and helicopters. And what he did was took a lot of that material and sold it as scrap metal and made money that way. And so, you know, this is an organization that has been around for over 30 years and has relationships that, you know, likely reach back that far with certain industries and also certain parts of the globe. And, you know, one of the most interesting documents that we read was actually on the cover of the Haqqani Network's magazines. They talk about, you know, during the anti-Soviet jihad, if you want to donate funds, here are the five offices that we have in the Middle East, three of them in the UAE, and two of them in Saudi Arabia, with phone numbers and in some cases addresses at these places. And, you know, the individual who was the first person to sort of set up that network, you know, he writes several articles in the magazines, and he talks about sort of there being a team of people that were sent over to sort of facilitate these types of donations and financial relationships. Now, you can imagine that, you know, the Haqqanis were doing that in the 1980s, and I can't say this with absolute certainty, but it's likely that the Haqqanis probably have maintained some of that infrastructure, or at least have people who have seasoned experience over there and all, you know, ties and relationships. And the Haqqanis have leveraged that to do what they do, remain effective. You know, I think one of the interesting things is the Haqqanis and their resilience. And so you have this issue where, you know, the U.S. military coalition partners, Afghan, you know, military security forces are, you know, the Haqqanis have been a target of this organization, of all these different actors. And yet they continue to sort of be resilient and rebound. Part of that is manpower. So sort of motivating people to continue to fight. Maybe that's, you know, could be part of their efforts in sort of the educational sphere. You know, and then you also have the resources to be able to keep things going. And I'm not saying that this requires a tremendous amount of resources, but yet the organization has been able to continue operations and do so in a way that has, you know, been somewhat strategic in certain areas and difficult for the Afghan government and the U.S., you know, coalition forces to manage since 2001. So I think their infrastructure is something that needs to be taken seriously. And my personal opinion is that I think more could be done to understand that infrastructure and also to sort of take it seriously in the sense that, you know, that it should be looked at over a long-term horizon. Because I think that really to understand it today is it really, you know, it needs to be informed by a solid understanding of what that infrastructure actually looked like in further detail than we currently have in the past.
Interesting. Despite the U.S.'s extensive drone campaign in really Haqqani heartland, the network's focus seems to have remained solidly on regional targets. Do you think, looking forward, that there's any possibility of the Haqqani network becoming involved directly in attacks beyond South Asia? Or do you think that this is really going to remain contained by its relationship with Pakistani intelligence?
I think the latter. I think if the current state of play holds in terms of what that relationship looks like between the Haqqanis and the state of Pakistan, I think that the dynamics of that relationship will will help to ensure that that relationship, help to ensure the Haqqanis stay more regionally oriented. It also appears that that could also be something that they are actually that they understand that that's their comparative advantage, is actually acting regionally and locally. So, that would be my read on that issue. However, I think, another interesting question is, given, 13 years of war, you mentioned the drone strikes, and the loss of, an important variable here too is the loss of senior Haqqani family members and leaders, Nasir Haqqani, Badruddin Haqqani, recently detained in Afghanistan, Anas Haqqani, Haji Mali Khan in Afghanistan, a whole bunch of different individuals. And so, could that push the group to be sort of more internationally oriented? I don't think there's enough information to sort of come out with absolute certainty on that issue. I think that it's unlikely that the Haqqanis, even if they were to have that viewpoint, I don't see them acting in a way where they would be out front of, international attack or plot, unless dynamics changed in the region and sort of the status quo changed. So that would be how I would think about that issue, is that, in the Haqqanis, I think the important thing here is that they've also seemed to have continued to play a role as an enabler for organizations like Al-Qaeda and others, other transnationally motivated jihadist groups who want to operate outside of the region. I think that typically when people look at this issue, they think, all right, well, is it Al-Qaeda? Would the Haqqanis go global? I think that's one way to look at it, and that's important. But I also think it's important to sort of think about this issue and this question in terms of like a system where, there's a division of labor where you have entities like Al-Qaeda who benefit from their relationship with the Haqqanis in a local regional context, and have historically, and while the Haqqanis might not be the agent conducting an attack, maybe another helpful way to think about this is from a material support perspective. Is that sort of looking at it through the lens of, all right, well, the Haqqanis through various periods of time have provided material support to Al-Qaeda, who has directly been implicated, and involved in those types of international attacks. I think division of labor is important to think about with respect to this issue. But it's hard to know where this is going to go. I think it's also important to recognize that things can change, and who knows? I mean, after 13 years of war and after losing a lot of family members, the Haqqanis might say, hey, look, this relationship isn't worth it anymore with Al-Qaeda or with transnational jihadis. We just want to focus on our local regional fight, let them do their thing. Maybe we'll still maintain relationships. And that could even be what the relationship looks like today. It's just hard to accurately, to sort of really make a judgment on that because of the lack of information, at least that exists in the open source, to inform that question.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion, Don. I'm wondering if you might let us know what's next for you. Any upcoming projects?
Sure. I have my hands in a variety of different projects at the CTC. Editing some work looking at evolution of Al-Qaeda and Iraq's financing, also helping out with a piece that looks at the evolution of Central Asian jihadist groups active in Afghanistan and Pakistan since 9/11. And I've also sort of emboldened by our Haqqani research, or at least inspired by it, I've also been involved in an effort to acquire primary source material produced by other Pakistan and Afghanistan-based militant groups, historical and current material. And so I've been, what we're trying to do is to set up, a collection of material, which I think would complement other efforts that are going on from other scholars who are working on similar projects. Personally, in terms of other research, I'm interested in looking at the evolution of
transnational terrorism from Pakistan-based groups and to look at it historically. And I hope to do that within the next year or two.
Interesting indeed. Well, thank you very much, Don, for joining us on New Books in National Security.
Thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure.